Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we speak of what were once thought of as two very discrete areas of law. But this we'll find is not always the case. Lately, both immigration and crime are in the news. Even for people legally here for generations, even minor infractions that most people would agree are neither serious nor violent can have serious consequences, while others may not. Tonight, we take a look at criminal law, immigration law, and where these two legal disciplines converge. Criminal practitioners must advise their clients. After investigating, they have to tell them the specific consequences, specific immigration consequences of a plea or conviction that could befall these clients based on their individual status. But criminal practitioners have not always been good at doing so. Mindful that individuals have, for years, been induced into pleas that later lead to disastrous consequences, for many, the immigration consequences of conviction take a far greater toll than would any penal sanction. The California legislature has created vehicles for reviewing past convictions and determining whether justice requires a conviction be set aside. We hear a lot about illegal entry into the nation these days. We hear far less about people living here for many years or even generations who face these consequences. In some cases, the victim of an offense might face life-altering consequences, such as a domestic violence victim whose non-citizen spouse faces deportation, leaving an American citizen victim to choose between losing his or her source of income amidst the breakup of the family unit, or leave the country to stay with his or her life partner following a minor incident where he or she never sought prosecution. And sometimes many years later. Perhaps you want to learn more about this growing area of concern, or want to learn how courts and prosecutors alike achieve justice when outside forces constrain what options are open to the parties of a case. Do you seek legal advice for a close friend or family member? Perhaps you're a criminal defense attorney, or prosecutor, or other legal practitioner. Call in for a 4-minute analysis. For starters, give us a call. Our phone number here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our guest can't provide you precise legal advice in just a few-minute-long phone call where they lack the facts of your specific case, and their legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their employers or clients, but they're here to help, to inform, to educate, to give you some guidance to help find your own answers, to give you resources where you can go for help. They're here to help. And joining us tonight are Carla Vanessa Gomez and Juan Prieto. Courtesy of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, Juan Prieto is a digital strategist and graphic designer based in Oakland, California, an immigrant from Mexicali, Mexico himself. He works to implement narrative-shifting strategies in the context of crimmigration for the emerging world of digital communications. Juan's comprehensive understanding of the ways that digital space can be used to cultivate transformative change began when he was first targeted by a far-right extremist after writing a series of opinion pieces for the New York Times. Since then, he's helped train and empower young advocates across California to use digital communications to shift the public discourse around immigration, detention, and against the propaganda of criminalization. As the statewide communication strategies at the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance, One led the digital communications effort, which helped free hundreds of people from detention centers across California under the banner, "To Free Them All." Carla Gomez recently joined the Private Defender Program in San Mateo County as an in-house attorney where she focuses on the intersection of criminal and immigration law, including post-conviction relief, as she previously did as a senior staff attorney in the San Francisco office of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Ms. Gomez co-authored Criminal Post-Conviction Relief for Immigrants, How to Use Criminal Courts to Erase the Immigration Consequences of Crimes, which was published by the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, first edition, 2023. Carl has over 20 years criminal defense experience as both a federal and a county public defender, and has extensive experience as an immigration defense attorney. Before coming to the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, Carla started her career as a federal public defender in San Diego, both as a trial and appellate attorney. Carla then became a San Francisco public defender, where she practiced for over 15 years as a felony attorney. And in 2017, she was part of the team that spearheaded the immigration unit. Carla successfully defended the most challenging cases in immigration court, where her clients with serious felony convictions have won asylum, withholding, the Convention Against Torture, and readjustment of status. Her successful post-conviction relief practice throughout California has saved lawful permanent residents with aggravated felonies from deportation and allowed non-citizens to adjust their status. Without further ado, Carla, Juan, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Juan, I'd like you to set the stage for us. Tell us some of the things that you would say to help empower young attorneys and young people to join in this growing area.
Yeah, where do I begin to set the stage as it pertains to all of this? I think what we're seeing is the rise of what I call the propaganda of criminalization, which is the intentional demonization of a group of people who are then scapegoated for the failures of public welfare policy. It was something we obviously faced in the 80s, right? As communities of color, particularly Black Americans, were targeted around the hysteria of the war on drugs. In particular, there was an unknown drug that people were not really familiar with making its way through the streets.
Of course, it turned out our government developed.
Right. Much like people who work for the San Jose Police Department bringing in fentanyl and blaming immigrants, right? So it's not unlike that. We're facing something that's not that different from what we faced in the 80s. Similar talking points are being espoused by our opposition, exploiting the hardships of poor people to justify more funding for policing and enforcement. And in the case of immigration, detention and deportation. So we're seeing that finger erroneously being pointed at vulnerable communities instead of the failed policy that led to a divestment from public welfare and an actual public safety, right? So making sure that people's basic needs were being met. So it's easy for the fear-mongering right to use this moment to try to increase enforcement on our streets, making the argument that it's crime and not poverty that is rising in the country. Immigrants then become an easier target of this campaign, especially after the platform the previous administration gave to anti-immigrant sentiments. So the results of that is sort of pushback that we've been seeing around the work in California to ensure that due process is given to all Californians, right? It is a known fact that 3 out of 10 Californians are immigrants themselves, right? 1 in 2 child in our school system have a parent who is an immigrant. So these are policies that are meant to protect all Californians that are then pushed back against by these harmful narratives that try to play the scapegoat and put the blame on immigrants. And so what I would say to any aspiring advocate or immigration attorney or attorney looking at immigration law with curiosity is that we need to enter this field with that understanding that for sure there is the legal context that needs to be studied, but there's also a way in which the media landscape plays a role in how policy and the end results of any court decision as it pertains to immigration are impacted by that discourse.
The only area of what you said that I would take issue with is that the fear mongering is not limited to the far right. I would guess between the three of us, we could not name a single politician who lost his or her seat because they overly frightened people about things that they were claiming to fix. Never happens. No media outlet has lost commercials because they scare people. Fear sells. Fear gets people elected. What are we making people afraid of this week? And both parties, both the far left and the far right, frighten people. We need to listen and listen to the message and really question it. We need not to take so much for granted and blindly listen to what our leaders are telling us. But let me shift over to Carla. Carla, we've spoken before of such landmark cases as Padilla versus Kentucky and In re Soriano, and the evolving duty of defense attorneys and prosecutors alike in terms of immigration, things that are way outside of the realm of criminal law, but are really now part of it. Can you tell us a little bit about that evolution and where we are now?
Yeah. So to Juan's point, in 1996, at the height of the war on drugs, Congress revamped our immigration laws. And it was then at that time that Congress expanded the list of what they considered aggravated felonies. And so what does that mean? What's an aggravated felony? Well, initially, under the immigration law, it's exactly what you would think, right? An aggravated felony was something very serious. It was a homicide, a rape case, something very serious. But in 1996, at the height of the war on drugs, Congress expanded that list to 33 offenses, most, which are not serious. They're not aggravated, there didn't even have to be a felony. So a misdemeanor, like a theft offense, for example, that had a max sentence of 1 year, that could be an aggravated felony. So California has gone through great lengths to try to minimize these draconian immigration consequences. And I just want to highlight here the 2010 landmark case of Padilla versus Kentucky. And this is such an important case because the Supreme Court in 2010 recognized how far Congress went back in the 90s at the height of the war on drugs and how any relatively minor offense could have these very draconian immigration consequences. And so in that case, in 2010, the Supreme Court held. So they found that the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution requires defense counsel to provide affirmative and competent advice to non-citizen defendants regarding the immigration consequences of their criminal case. So what does that mean? What is the Sixth Amendment? It means that you have to, as your duty to provide effective representation, you have to advise your client of the immigration consequences regarding their criminal case. So Mr. Padilla, I just have to talk about Mr. Padilla. He was here in this country for 40 years. He was a Vietnam vet, and he was actually charged with a relatively serious, it was a federal drug trafficking case. And under the immigration law, that is clearly an aggravated felony. And so he turns, though, to his defense attorney and he says, you know, I'm really worried that I could lose my LPR. I'm a lawful permanent resident and I can lose my status for this offense. And the attorney says, oh, no, don't worry about it. You're fine. You've been here for 40 years. Well, it was an aggravated felony. And what does that mean? An aggravated felony carries the most draconian immigration consequences. It meant that Mr. Padilla would be subject to automatic deportation. That means that the court, the immigration judge, wouldn't be able to consider the fact that he had lived here for 40 years, that he had served his country in the Vietnam War. He'd be subject to automatic deportation with no form of discretionary relief from deportation. So basically, he was signing over his deportation when he accepted that plea. In addition, he was subject to a lifetime banishment from the United States. And if he tried to re-enter the United States, he would be subject to federal illegal re-entry, which carries a max sentence of 20 years. So the court basically recognized that the immigration consequences are not collateral. They're not collateral consequences, that they're in fact a penalty, that it's part of the punishment. And they found that for non-citizens, deportation is an integral part of the penalty imposed. And maybe, as you stated earlier, Jeff, it may be the most serious penalty flowing from the conviction. So this was the landmark case in 2010. And because of this, all defense attorneys all throughout the United States, they have to give this specific advisal to their non-citizen clients. But I have to explain that here we're in California, and as Juan mentioned, one in four residents in California are foreign born, and one in two kids who are U.S. citizens have a parent that is foreign born. And so the legislature here has really, they have protected our non-citizens, and they've gone to great lengths to do so. And so we have had here in California since 1987, defense attorneys have had the duty to give this specific advisal to their clients. And in 2004, since 2004, defense attorneys have had this duty to mitigate. So we have to go farther. We don't just have to give an advisal. We have to know as defense attorneys, what are immigration neutral offenses for our non-citizen clients? And that depends on what kind of status your client has. Does your client have, is an LPR? Does your client have DACA?
Let me interject for a second. For our listeners, LPR is a lawful permanent resident. DACA is the deferred action, right? Let me take just a moment here. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. Tonight, we're talking about criminal law and immigration law and the areas where they converge. A very specific legal program that you're only going to hear here on KALW. KALW has generously opened its doors for this program for some 40 years, and you will hear from practitioners in all areas of law, get all kinds of guidance, find all sorts of resources in the community that you will not hear anyone else. It's been that way for a long time, and only because KALW has generously made this available to all of us. Not to me, but to all of us in this community. So we would like to repay that favor. We would like to thank them. But I would also ask that you make your generous donation today, either at KALW.org or by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-KALW-917. And please join us. Help us to keep the doors open so that shows such as this one are remain available, remain here for you. We're here to help. We need to help the station so that we can continue to help you.
Hey, Jeff, this is Joanne Marr. And I want to remind people that we're in the first day of KALW Spring Membership Drive, and we want to get this first day off to a good start. It would be great if we could convince six of you to come forward now in support of your legal rights. And that's our goal for this hour. Six of you going online at KALW.org and making your contribution, or by calling us at 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917. As Jeff mentioned, Your Legal Rights has been on the air for many years. In fact, it's our oldest locally produced program on KALW. It was originally started by Chuck Finney as a public service, dispensing legal information on a wide range of topics: immigration, landlord-tenant, tax tips, labor and consumer rights, debtors' rights. Chuck is no longer with us, but Jeff Hayden has taken his place and he's carrying on. And Jeff does this entirely as a volunteer. He does not get a penny from KALW. So we want you to show your appreciation for what Jeff does every week on Your Legal Rights by calling in with whatever you can afford at 800-525-9917 or going online, KALW.org, KALW.org.
And with that, let me turn it over to Juanita from Berkeley. Juanita, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a very good friend that was 10 years older than me and 10 years younger than my mom. And she was an immigrant from Mexico. But her parents came here and they settled down in San Diego, so they had property on the other side of the border. So she would constantly come up here and try to help her relatives that were being incarcerated. And then she got dementia and her daughter took all her property and put her in some kind of home where nobody knew where she was. And so I just felt so bad for her. And there was nothing I could do. I had the daughter's number, but she would not answer the phone because I wanted to visit her. We were friends for years. She married a guy from Louisiana, and she had a French last name. So the only way you could tell that she was Spanish was her first name was Rosa, the same as my mom. And so I feel so bad that I could not do anything. And now I have a sister going through the same thing. And I can't depend on her anymore. And my daughter is not in this state. And I have relatives that are squatting in my mom's home. And I can't do anything about it. The police is saying I can't get a lawyer. I have to get a lawyer from the Alameda County legal aid. I've been calling them for 2 months. Nobody's returned my call.
Have you tried the Bar Association, the Alameda County Bar Association?
That's what I'm talking about, that Alameda County Bar Association. And someone called and said, I'm probably going to be your lawyer. But then she never answered my phone calls, or AT&T never let her get through.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that and that this is going on with you. It's really not quite what we're going into today, unfortunately. And I don't know that our guests are in a position to really be of help or to address the issues. It's sad to hear. You might stick it out with the Alameda County Bar Association, might be your best bet. You might try going to their website at acba.org. See if you can find a way to get in and self-refer to the lawyer referral service, or keep trying. Their phone number is 510-302-2222, if I remember correctly. And they are maybe your best bet.
I've been trying to reach her for 2 months, and I've never reached her, and she never reached me.
If that fails, you might try. Where is the home located?
In Oakland.
You might try the lawyer referral service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. They may be able to back it up or find a way for you to get in. Their number is 415-989-1616.
Okay. Thank you so much, because I ran out. I called the inspector. I had got two inspectors from the DA to look into it, and they said, well, Ms. Ellis, you need a lawyer. We can't do anything for you.
Right. It's largely a civil remedy to get them evicted. I wish you the best of luck. I wish I could be of more help. But thank you for joining us.
At least I have another resource. I appreciate that.
I wish you the best. And Carla, before we moved off, you were talking about the line of cases, what rights they recognized. These aren't new rights they created. These have been in effect forever, but suddenly they've awakened them. And they've awakened the California legislature as well. We have about 5 minutes before we have to break, and I would love to give you an opportunity to tell us more about some of the tools that have been created in that regard as well.
Yeah. So in 2015, the California legislature, they codified, so they've put into law what we already had in law, what we already had in our case law, but we have codified Padilla versus Kentucky, and this line of cases where the lawyers have to not only give the specific advisal, but in addition, lawyers have to mitigate the immigration consequences through plea negotiations. And so basically, what does that mean? That means that a lawyer needs to understand which offense is immigration neutral for their client and which one is not. So for example, I just have to give an example because this is so counterintuitive. So for a lawful permanent resident, a burglary may be an immigration neutral offense, while an 11-550, something called being under the influence of a drug, again, because of the height of the war on drugs, that is actually a deportable controlled substance offense.
And with that, I wanted to throw in one thing. You earlier commented about trafficking. And for purposes of state law, for purposes of a criminal prosecution, trafficking sounds like a pretty draconian thing. But for immigration purposes, trafficking can simply be having simple possession for your own use on two or more occasions. So one of the areas I want to talk to you about as we go further is that sometimes from a criminal perspective and the things that are, as a criminal practitioner, I see every day, we see things as non-serious for us for immigration purposes. They're horrific. And sometimes making something more serious on the criminal side gives them immigration relief. They're not parallel, but I didn't mean to interrupt. You can go ahead.
So that's absolutely right. This area is very counterintuitive because it's the interplay of federal, how we define a federal law versus our state law, and it's the intersection of the two. And that's why it makes absolutely no sense. But like you were saying, like a federal, like what is considered a drug trafficking offense? Something being in possession of a relatively small amount of drugs. Maybe a police officer comes up to you and says, "Hey, I'll give you $25 for your, you know, your rock or whatever." And all of a sudden you've sold drugs and now you're a seller. You're no longer just someone that is addicted to drugs and in possession of the drugs. So you suddenly have sold drugs, and that is the worst offense that you can commit for immigration purposes is selling drugs. So you're absolutely right. It doesn't mean that you're a big time drug dealer, right? And even minor, relatively minor, simple possession charges have very serious consequences. And an example is marijuana. And I have to talk about marijuana because here in California, marijuana is legalized. And let's say you go and can you go work at one of these marijuana drug dispensaries? Is that something you can do having just DACA?
Right. That's what I was going to say. I think as a DACA recipient, I absolutely cannot. And I think that just highlights that's like a perfect example of just how much freedom, I guess, these systems were allowed given under the Constitution to be their own systems in and of themselves and create almost a two-tiered system that doubly punishes immigrants, where you have a substance that is legalized by a state, is then criminalized federally and has larger immigration consequences than if you're a citizen who is partaking in this or even joining this industry, right? I can't, even if I might have a brilliant idea of how to market marijuana, for example, I can't actually pursue that because I am now being, it would be charged with someone who works in the industry that sells marijuana. And there we go. There's a reason to deport me. I think the other example of how these immigration systems differ depending on like which tier of immigrant you are too, right? For example, if you're like me and you have DACA and you drive under the influence, you can lose this work permit. But if you're a lawful permanent resident, it's as simple as wet and reckless, right? And that is removed from the consequences in immigration. And so I think there's so many varying obstacles that are placed on immigrants. And then even within that identity, right, the different types of statuses impact have different consequences for the immigrant themselves.
Yeah. And that's like a really good point that you mentioned about knowing, like a defense attorney has to really understand their client's status. So like you said perfectly, Juan, if he cannot be convicted of a DUI. A simple DUI would render him deportable. He would lose his DACA status. While a lawful permanent resident, they could accept a DUI. That's not going to render them deportable. So it really matters, your status and what kind of status really, really matters.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we want to talk about some of the things that have changed of late, some of the tools that are available, and some of the resources available for everyone who might have immigration issues and the attorneys who assist them. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. But the number that we want you to call now during our the first day of our KALW Spring Membership Drive is 800-525-9917, or you can go online and make your contribution to KALW at kalw.org, kalw.org. And during this hour of Your Legal Rights, we have a goal of six. That's six of you calling in your support at 800-525-9917. Or going online, kalw.org. Now, we know that lots of you listen to this program to get educated on voter protections, on immigration, landlord-tenant, taxes, drug courts, abortion, rights to privacy, reforming the cash bail system, you know, whatever it is. This is a wide-ranging discussion program. And if your legal rights has been at all helpful to you, then it's time for you to call in your contribution, show your appreciation, give what you can afford. Become a new member at the $50 level at 800-525-9917 or online kalw.org. If you can afford a little more, think about becoming a monthly supporter at $10, $15, $20 a month. You can choose the level of your support, whatever is comfortable for you, $50, $100 a month. That's fine with us. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
And even I do that at the monthly support level. And this station has allowed us to bring to you such people as justices of the California Supreme Court or such people in the news as then Professor John Eastman, who, as you know, is being prosecuted for his activities on January 6th. We try to bring you all viewpoints. We hope that you can join us in supporting this station and keeping the doors open. 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're discussing crimmigration. That's the intersection of criminal law and immigration law. By the looks on my guest's face, I may have pronounced that a little wrong. If you need help or are just interested, perhaps looking out for somebody, my guests are here to help. Questions from my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, toll free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You don't have to jump in exactly where we are in our conversation. And as our conversation was progressing, Carla, you were talking a little bit about some of the changes. But as I understand it, these changes aren't limited to just us defense attorneys. They hit others in the system as well, up to and including prosecutors, do they not?
That's right. So California, again, we have codified this under 1016 point, Penal Code 1016.3. Prosecutors also have a responsibility to our non-citizen clients, and they must, and it's fairly clear, California has gone as far to say that prosecutors must consider the adverse immigration consequences during plea negotiations in order to reach a just result. And this language is taken straight from Padilla versus Kentucky. So this is actually coming from the United States Supreme Court. Prosecutors have to take this into consideration in order to reach a just result. We don't want our U.S. citizen children to be left abandoned because their father perhaps was convicted of a relatively minor drug offense. So we have the responsibility as defense attorneys to give the specific advisal, to make sure we really understand, research the consequences, and to mitigate the immigration consequences through plea negotiations. And the district attorney also has to consider this.
Is it good enough for a district attorney to be reviewing the materials that are sent to him or her and respond back, well, because this person is dangerous, we're not doing anything? Or do they really have to look at different alternatives?
You know, I if you look at Padilla versus Kentucky closely, and if you look at the language of what Congress here, our state legislator, has written, it's really clear that these laws are meant to defend and to protect our non-citizens. So they must consider reasonable alternatives. And again, we're not saying that if your client is charged with a very serious strike offense that you're going to say, oh, no, just give my client this relatively minor misdemeanor offense. There are many offenses that are very serious that can be considered in lieu of an alternative serious offense, right? And that's where the interplay comes between this crime and immigration. And that's why you need an expert, a crime immigration expert, that can give you those reasonable alternatives, right?
Are there many crime immigration experts in California today?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question. The Immigrant Legal Resource Center, Kathy Brady, has been at the forefront of this movement for over 30 years, and she has trained up a great, like, soldiers. In most California public defender offices, there is a crime immigration expert, and we meet every week. There is a weekly call, and we discuss, you know, challenging cases. And sometimes, you know, our clients are facing very serious charges, and we brainstorm these cases and we try to come up with reasonable alternatives that we can offer. So yes, there are. This is a growing area, and we need more, but it is a class that's being taught now in law school, and more law schools are offering crime immigration.
And you recently began working with the Private Defender Program in San Mateo County. Have most counties started moving in that direction to have somebody available to assist the attorneys?
Yes, I mean, that's best practice. And most public defender offices have an in-house, what they could call Padilla attorney. So San Francisco, Santa Clara, Alameda, most public defender offices in California have a crime immigration expert on staff. It's best practice because you need an attorney who understands the value of a case in that county. So something that may be acceptable in San Francisco may not be acceptable in San Mateo, for example. So you really need to understand the culture of that county. And it's just best practice to have someone on hand the attorneys can reach if they're in court and they've been offered some sort of a favorable disposition, perhaps, for their client.
It doesn't do any good for somebody charged with attempted murder for an assault with an automobile to be represented by somebody who thinks that the only answer is to ask for disturbing the peace infraction. You need to be realistic about the specific area. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. You have to understand the value of a case. That's right. But I think most of us, we understand that you're not going to be getting a misdemeanor for a very serious offense, right?
Absolutely. And again, one thing I learned some time ago is that the California designation of felony and misdemeanor doesn't necessarily hold a lot of meaning when you look to immigration law. They do look at the maximum time for an offense and the amount of time somebody got, but that distinction doesn't really hold water.
This is a really good point that you make about what is a, in your, where we're talking about aggravated felonies. When we were looking at the definition of an aggravated felony, so for example, a theft offense that carries a sentence of 1 year or more would be an aggravated felony, right? So most, wait, just a minute. So most misdemeanors prior to 2015, when we changed the law, a misdemeanor offense carried a max sentence of 1 year. So since it was 1 year, that was the max, then you could easily have a misdemeanor be an aggravated felony. So the ILRC, always one step ahead, or decided to change the max sentence. So I think it was Kathy Brady, again, who was at the forefront of this, I think with Drug Policy Alliance. And they went to the legislature and they proposed that we change the misdemeanor from a max sentence of 364 days instead of 365 days to avoid that situation. So in California, we're fortunate that misdemeanors have a maximum sentence of 364 days instead of 365 days to avoid that unjust situation. But unfortunately, in other states, that's not the case. And so you can still have a misdemeanor be an aggravated felony.
I think we hear this a lot in advocacy too. Like, folks will immediately jump to convictions that might scare the public, right? Kind of tapping into that fear mongering we were talking about earlier. And I think what we're trying to do here in California, or what we're pushing to accomplish, is actually create a system that treats everyone equally under the eyes of the law. What we currently have is that system that's consistently punishing immigrants through the criminal legal sense, and they go through whatever consequences come from that, and then being vetted through an immigration system that then can result in their deportation. And so I think it's important for folks to understand that there's this constant narrative over hyper-focus on, you know, violent crimes, or, well, this just happened here, why shouldn't we attack sanctuary policy all over the country? And the reality is that sanctuary policies and policies that try to mitigate that relationship between criminal courts and immigration courts is actually trying to get rid of a two-tiered system, as opposed to create one. What we currently have is what the opposition has been constantly trying to frame our initiatives as wanting to create.
And Juan, can I ask you a quick question? Just for our audience, like, can you tell us, like, what is immigration like? Like, so let's say someone takes an aggravated felony conviction and they go, I know they are transported from prison straight to ICE. What does that look like, and what happens when they're in ICE proceedings?
Yeah, and that's the other piece of it. I work a lot with people who are either previously detained or have been freed from detention themselves, and the stories of what they experienced in there is abysmal. There are sometimes, segregated for long periods of time, people being isolated for a year, even if not more. That obviously has an impact on their mental health, what they call the hielera, right, the ICE room. And so I think the approach for these facilities is consistently to demonize the people who are in them and continue that narrative by acting on their own accord and their own morals. And so you have instances where people are taking their own lives while they're detained because the conditions in there are unlivable. We saw, particularly in the pandemic, just how little they care about the lives of people there, right? So as we were all masking up and hearing the science behind the need to self-distance, they were instead cramming them in these detention facilities, allowing the disease to spread rampant, and people lost their lives. And I think that personifies just how harmful these facilities are, right? This isn't just another jail, which are also harmful to an individual, right? These are almost another layer of that, in that the dehumanization has been so powerful that once the folks who look over them have them under their possession, there's very little regard to their humanity. Folks will oftentimes report going through pretty horrific medical conditions and having no medical assistance whatsoever. So that's what we're really dealing with here, right? The system that's either meant to dehumanize you through detention facilities or deport, which can oftentimes lead to death.
And just to piggyback off of that, I think what's so different from our criminal system is that in immigration, even though you're subject to mandatory detention, so a simple possession offense is a deportable offense. So simple possession of, it could be like cultivation of marijuana, but just a simple possession of methamphetamine or cocaine will land you in deportation proceedings. And what's shocking is that even for a lawful permanent resident, you're subject to something called mandatory detention. You're not entitled to a bond. And so in order to fight your case, you have to be detained. And the other striking difference is that you're not entitled to an attorney. And so even though you are being detained and you're not facing, this is an immigration proceeding, not a criminal, you are not allowed to have, you're not entitled to an attorney.
And I'd like to circle back to that momentarily. For a moment, I do want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW in the San Francisco Bay Area. The only way the station can stay on the air is through listeners, that is, listeners like you. To keep this station going, to make programs like this one available to others, to be able to afford you this type of information and this type of advice, we need to keep the airs open. We need to keep the station on the air. Please consider making your donation to KALW today, either by calling us at 800-525-9917, or that's KALW at 800-KALW-917, or online at KALW.org. This is the first day of our pledge drive. We're seeking six callers or six people to go online and donate.
And we need five more to reach goal. Are there five more of you who can go to your phones and call us at 800-525-9917? Or you can go online, KALW.org. And keep in mind that Your Legal Rights is probably the only radio program of its kind in the Bay Area. I mean, this is an active community engagement show that gives our listeners the opportunity to have their legal questions answered. Your Legal Rights is such a valuable community resource that it deserves your support. So please help us meet our goal by the time this program ends at 7-800-525-9917 or online KALW.org.
And let me turn it over. We have a very short time left, but I want to turn it to Carolyn in Larkspur. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Carolyn, you're on the air. Are you with us? No, apparently not. One of the things that I wanted to give you a moment to talk about, we have another call coming through, but before we go, I wanted to talk a little bit about post-conviction. Some of these... Oh, we do have Carolyn from Larkspur on the line. Let me take her call. And Carolyn, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. This is a very good program.
Thank you.
You know, my question has to do with, you know, naturalized, you have to, it's a federal jurisdiction. So what I don't understand in this whole discussion, I'm not anti-immigrant, pro-immigrant, or anything. I just don't understand why the states, in our case, California, thinks we can change what the federal government does and make our laws different. And that's my disagreement with this. I actually have a horse, and at the ranch, all of the guys who work there are not here documented. And they tell me they go back to Mexico, and they pay someone between $10,000 and $30,000 to get back out here. And if they get detained, well, they're released and given a trial date that they never go to. So I have to say, I do have a problem with that a little bit, because we are a country of laws. And if we don't like the laws, then we have to change them on the national level, because being a citizen is part of the federal government. It's not part of the state government. And I think it's unfair to have all of these, including California. And Texas has extreme anti-immigrant laws. California has pro-immigrant. This is not the way to run a country. That's what my comment is. I'll
Carolyn,
take my response off the air.
Thank you. We're a little off topic, but I'll tell you, you're not wrong. We need to have some centralized source. But we're really a little bit off topic. What we're talking about is much more specific and looking at draconian consequences of minor criminal convictions, how they can be avoided, and what's available for those cases from the past where that wasn't done, which is the last thing I want to give you a chance to talk about that before we run out of time, which is coming very quickly.
I just want to respond to the caller's question. California does not enact immigration laws. I just want to be clear. You're right, absolutely right. The federal government enacts the immigration laws. There's been no reform in immigration law since 1996. That was when the big revamp was done. What we're talking about today is how do we protect our non-citizens from suffering from these draconian immigration consequences. And so, for example, an infraction of cultivation of marijuana, it's an infraction that is considered an aggravated felony under federal law. Now, you can't get around that. So let's say your lawyer leads you to something like that, and they didn't know that you are going to lose your status for this infraction, and you're going to lose your family, your entire life here in the United States, because of this infraction, and you've been living here legally for 40 years. So what do you do? Well, you can vacate the conviction. And in California, we have vacature laws that are recognized by the federal government. We have different penal code sections. But if your lawyer gets it wrong, or you didn't meaningfully understand the immigration consequences of your plea, you can vacate that conviction. And we have many different statutes and laws to vacate those convictions, including if you have been a victim of domestic violence or human trafficking. Those are recent laws as well that you can vacate your convictions if you are a direct victim of human trafficking when you committed the offense, or you were suffering from, or you were a victim of intimate partner violence.
And even for somebody who has some knowledge of the law or even knowledge of the criminal justice system, there are so many new tools and they're so specific. You really need to go into the community, to the folks that know this area. And even as a criminal defense attorney for 30 years, I go to these folks because it's that specialized.
That's right. I'm not going to get into all the details because it's not a law program. If you think you have a conviction, you didn't understand the immigration consequences, it's causing some sort of immigration harm, then you should consult with a crim immigration expert. And many public defender offices have experts on hand, and they can do an analysis for you.
We're essentially out of time, and I did promise before we started I would give each of you some time for any closing thoughts, closing remarks. Juan, let me turn to you first. Would you like to take about 2 minutes?
Yeah, no, definitely. And just generally for speaking to any young person who's looking to become an immigration attorney or get in the field of advocacy for immigrants, the reality is that not many people understand the political nature of immigration courts. They assume that they function in the same way that all other courts that fall under the judiciary branch of our government are ran. But they have, no idea that they actually fall under the executive branch of governance, right? And so host judges that are appointed by whoever might be sitting in office. So in nature, you know, the immigration system is part of that same apparatus that is trying to remove people from the country, not actually a system of justice. Dana Marks, a former president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, considers immigration courts or cases, death penalty cases, in a traffic court setting. And that's exactly what we're dealing with. And we need immigration attorneys and advocates who understand how all of these mechanisms come into play, both the inherited political structure of an immigration court and the impact that media landscape might have on any given ruling and public discourse, as we kind of heard a little bit earlier.
And as we were saying earlier, the immigration courts don't look anything like the courts we expect in a criminal case. You don't have an independent judge. The judge actually works for the agency that's looking to deport or otherwise sanction you. You don't have the rights to bail. It's, in most instances, it's a really horrific experience. Juan, is it, if I were facing immigration problems, am I going to be in front of a court right here in the Bay Area, or am I likely to find myself somewhere?
It definitely depends on so many different factors, but the likelihood is that you might be sent elsewhere. I think currently there's like even more immigration courts opening elsewhere, considering the way the media has created a lot of hysteria around immigration as opposed to just looking at the facts.
But yes, all my resources are here.
Yeah, there are 200 immigration detention facilities across the country. I once had a client who was a juvenile, and he had an asylum case pending out of New York City. He was transferred from ICE in New York all the way to California, and I found him in a detention facility when I was visiting another client. So we were able to eventually get him out. He was fortunate that I represented him pro bono, but without an attorney, it's very, very hard to win these cases. It's almost impossible to win without an attorney.
Carly, you're down to about a half a minute. Do you have any closing thoughts you want to throw out?
No, just again, if you need any assistance or you have any questions about a prior conviction that you think was you didn't understand the immigration consequences causing you harm, please, please go to the public defender office in which the conviction was based out of. And again, they have clean slate programs and they can assist. Also, the immigrant, for attorneys who don't understand this area of law, I encourage you to reach out to the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. That is, we assist, or the ILRC assists lawyers in this area, and ILRC has a lot of resources. I am now in San Mateo County at the Private Defender Program, which I just want to be very clear is an indigent defense program. So we represent clients who can't afford a lawyer.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been discussing an overview of a revolution in criminal defense and immigration. Our guests tonight have been Carla Gomez of the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association and Juan Prieto of the Immigrants Legal Resource Center. Please join us next week on Your Legal Rights, where, as always, we take your calls and answer your questions. In 2 weeks, our bi-monthly landlord-tenant broadcast, and coming in April, was it the Gone Girl case or a case of confirmation bias? What does that mean? Well, you're going to have to tune in and find out. A big thanks to tonight's guests, Juan Prieto and Carla Gomez, and thank you for joining us. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. At the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night. And
support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.